I'm Joe Kane.
I'm Dan Kane.
I'm Sal Conca.
And I'm Wayne Heckler.
And this is the Imperfect Podcast.
Don't forget to go to hecklerkane.com and sign up to become an Imperfect Podcast Insider.
To the bumper.
This week's guest on the Imperfect Podcast is Fran Strine, who created the music documentary Hired Gun.
Yeah, we got a good chance to talk to him, and it was a lot of fun to see this movie.
Well, as musicians, I think I was the first one to watch it.
Yeah.
And I was just completely enthralled. I had to share it with everybody. I texted all of my friends and said, go watch this damn thing. If you're a musician, you're going to love this movie.
It's on Netflix right now.
Exactly. Trending film on Netflix. It's been doing gangbusters. Filmed in 2016. It has a plethora of musical talent from Alice Cooper, Rob Zombie, Steve Vai, David Foster, Ray Parker Jr., the drummer for Billy Joel, the drummer for John Cougar Mellencamp, which I'm ruining the whole thing by not saying their names, which is the
Liberty
point.
DeVito and Kenny Aronoff.
Thank you, Joe.
You're welcome. these are guys I'm huge fans of.
Exactly. So Fran was a music photographer for years. He toured with bands like Staind and Nickelback and so many others that it's just impossible to name them all. And this opportunity came up for him. He was looking to do something different with his career, coming off the road, and he became a filmmaker. He had done a lot of behind-the-scenes videos for a lot of bands and things like that, which kind of launched him to this place. You know, it was interesting to hear his story on how he got an investor to work with him on the film and how he got the whole thing shot. I mean, you know, this film, a documentary like this, hard work. 2 years of
shooting. 2 years of labor. Yeah. You're talking about something that was really a passion project that he just – this was part of his life. He was a part of this community. He was just documenting it the whole time on camera and now has changed over to, you know, film.
And, you know, one of the really great stories was hearing how, you know, he knows George Lucas lives in the same area as him and – getting the music produced at Skywalker Ranch.
Exactly, exactly. Very cool story.
This documentary is definitely something to suggest to friends, especially being musicians. This
Absolutely.
Is something to definitely check
Absolutely.
Out. Especially if you grew up 80s, 90s.
Yep. Yeah, whether you're a filmmaker or a musician or somebody that just loves music, this documentary is one to see. And, you know, listening to what Fran has to say as a filmmaker, you definitely want to hear and listen to the rest of this interview. Yeah. So hope you guys enjoy. If you have questions for Fran, leave them in the comments. Don't forget, check out our YouTube channel, and let's hear from Fran. Fran, welcome to the Imperfect Podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm great, man. Thanks for having me on.
Awesome. You're calling in from sunny California, I believe.
Well, I'm in Northern California. It's a little sunny but chilly tonight.
Oh, yeah. You got a little chill.
So
huh?
Not so much sun.
Setting up for Christmas time.
Yeah, you guys might have a white Christmas up there or what?
Yeah. Not even. 10 minutes north of the Golden Gate Bridge in a little town called San Rafael, home of Star Wars and Indiana Jones and Lucasfilm and all that stuff.
Nice.
And, you know, I run into George Lucas every once in a while at my Starbucks.
Oh, wow.
But he's the most unapproachable person on the planet Earth.
No.
So it's like nobody makes eye contact with him. Nobody talks to him. They know better, you know. He's the wizard alone.
What I found most interesting about that is that he gets his own Starbucks.
If anybody wants to stalk him, it's on 4th Street.
They wouldn't dare.
It's pretty funny.
That's hysterical. So you're here to talk about Hired Gun, your latest documentary that's been going pretty crazy on Netflix. I mean, I know it's been a trending movie on there. You shot it in 2016. What was the motivation for you to shoot this film, Hired Gun?
Yeah, so I was a touring videographer, photographer for a bunch of artists for a bunch of years. The likes of Staind, Nickelback, Seether. And
I love Seether.
I had come off the road with Staind and was going to go into kind of like a sabbatical for a year just to kind of enjoy life because I've been on the road for 20 years. And I kept getting a call from these guys at Five Finger Death Punch. Now, I've heard of the band before. I didn't know much about them. Mm-hmm. And I just knew that they were on the rise. And they kept calling. I kept saying no. And they finally gave me an offer I just could not refuse. I just been a fool to turn it down financially. So I agreed to do it. And started. It was a world tour. starting in Tokyo and going around the whole planet down through New Zealand, Australia, all of Europe. By the time we got to Australia, and it's no secret, their singers had some substance abuse issues in regards to alcohol. And I was on the verge of turning 50 years old, and I'm thinking to myself, I'm touring with a band called Five Finger Death Punch. I'm 50 years old. I don't want to do this anymore. You know, my life, you know. So I decided to make a film, you know, like really dive in and make a quality, compelling movie and take my chances to see where it took me. And by the time we landed, you know, I think the last show was in Glasgow, I hit the ground running like 2 weeks later and didn't stop until the movie was finished.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah. And you also did a couple other things before this. Like what happened before? What was your first kind of breakthrough? Was it the Dolly Live or?
No, I was a tour photographer for a bunch of years before I picked up a camera. I have no formal education, filmmaking or photography. It's just hard work. You know, I don't really believe in luck. You know, I worked my ass off to get to this where I'm at right now. So I was on a tour called Tattoo the Earth back in 2000 with a bunch of metal bands as the tour photographer for the tour production. And I happened to just bring a Sony Handy Walkman or, you know, the camera thing. And I'm like, just going to document my memories. And I started shooting some of the bands live. I'm like, wow, man, moving pictures. This is way cooler than just taking a still image, you know. So that really intrigued me. And then I was living in Atlanta at the time, and a friend of mine's band called Seven Dust were in the studio with Butch Walker doing a record, and they invited me over just to film some stuff with my little handy cam. And I go in there, and the head of A&R for the record label is in there. It's like, oh, you do video? I'm like, yeah, I do video. You
know? Of course.
Talking about it. Didn't even own a computer, to be honest with you, at the time. This was in 2003.
That's like what they tell actors. Like, if they say, can you do? You go, yes, I can.
Yeah. Anyway, I got hired to do their bonus DVD. This was a thing when records started to slide a little bit, and they would put a company DVD of the making of the album. So I was hired on spot, not knowing what I was doing. And back then, they used to give real money. The label still had great budgets. So I took the half up front money they gave me and went out and bought a killer, I think it was a Sony PDF 150 at the time. I didn't have a computer. I didn't even know how to turn on a computer. So I went and bought the old iMac, I guess, the egg looking one.
Uh-huh. Yep.
And Final Cut 2, I think it was back then.
Okay.
And I inserted it all and opened it up and just got nauseous immediately. I'm like, what is this? I had no idea what I was doing. Uh-huh. And I bought Final Cut for Dummies. And that's how I created that piece. And then from there on, it was a really successful accompaniment piece for that CD. And word of mouth, and then here I am today, you know.
Nice, cool.
So that's how I started out, yeah. So I've done, you know, stuff for lots of music videos. The Dolly Live in London DVD was really big. That was my, at the time, that was the biggest thing I'd done prior to Hired Gun, and that got me a gold album.
And then you did something called A Battlefield of the Mind. You edited on that? You were an editor? What was that about?
Yeah, I did that as a kind of a passion project. When I was out with Stained, Aaron Lewis and I are both really into the troops and helping veterans or whatnot. And when I moved here to the Bay Area, I was shocked at the homeless situation. And I started engaging with some of these guys and come to find out there were a lot of more veterans returning back from Afghanistan, Iraqi wars. And I was just like, man, there's got to be a story here. So I did it. You know, it was a passion project. Didn't really sell it. Just kind of gave it to people. And it did make a difference. You know, it helped a lot of people. And I got to see some of the guys in the film that were homeless actually get their stuff together, get treatment, get jobs, and, you know, get into an apartment, which was really, really cool.
That's great. And what was the name of that again? I just want to make sure, because we'll put it in the show notes if it's available for people to check out.
Battlefield of the Mind.
Yeah, Battlefield of the Mind.
Okay, awesome. Yeah, I would love for people to check that out. We love to support the veterans as well. So,
yeah, for sure.
So you, where the motivation for this film? I know you wanted to get off the road, essentially. How do you go? How do you go from concept to production? And what was the initial concept of this to be able to shoot? I mean, it's specifically about studio musicians. So why was it important to tell their story?
Well, I'm not going to lie. I had seen 20 Feet from Stardom earlier that year. Mm-hmm. And that film really touched me. I'm like, wow, this is a real, it was shot well. Storytelling was superb. And I was like, there's another story here like this, you know, and me being in the music field for so many years, I've been in the studio with a bunch of bands, toured with many of them. So I was aware of the hired gun, session guy and live. So I was like, that story really hasn't been told, especially like our contemporaries. And I knew a lot of the people. So I just started reaching out to them. Kind of made a sizzle reel first, and we got an investor in who was a good friend of mine I met through Battlefield of the Mind, who funded just about the entire movie. I'd say 90% of it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I know that funding is one of the biggest issues for any filmmaker, especially in the doc space.
Yep.
But I can tell you, man, he came in, he asked no questions. If I needed something, it was always yes. And his name's Todd Poulsen. I've got to give him a shout out because he really believed in this movie and took the chance. And I thank him every day still.
That's awesome. What was, do you mind discussing, like, what was the budget for a film like this to make a documentary? And how long did it take to produce?
Well, I can't give the exact number out.
Sure.
Sure. We understand. A lot of people, it's tough sometimes to go, okay, this was how much it was, so.
Right, I'll tell you, it was under $1 million, more than a half a million.
Yeah.
So somewhere in between that. And what was the rest of your question? I'm sorry. Just what how much did it cost?
No, and then how long did production actually last? Like, how long did it take to put a piece like this together?
Yeah, the interview process was about 2 years, only because we had to wait for some of these artists to free up. Because a lot of them are working musicians. So, you know, the toughest one to get was Steve Lukather, because he's all over the place. And he's like, why should I tell you my story for free when I can go make my own Toto documentary? You know, yeah, hey, I get that. And then all of a sudden he started seeing Jay Grade, Ray Parker, David Foster, Kenny Aronoff, all his friends in the movie. He called me up the day before Christmas Eve and was like, I have to be in your movie now. All my friends are in your fucking movie. But you've only got to tomorrow. So I flew down Christmas Eve morning, interviewed him all day long, flew home, and he was the last guy we interviewed. Yeah.
Who was the first?
The first guy we interviewed was Paul Bushnell. And he's only got a little teeny clip in the film, which bums me out because the story is really amazing. But we interviewed 65 people.
Oh, wow.
30 people made the film, yeah. And he's a great guy, probably one of the greatest bass players I've ever heard. I mean, just really super nice guy, super cool story. Unfortunately, there's only so much time in a 98-minute doc that you know, you can really tell a story.
Sure.
How do you go about now? You take a look at all the footage you got. You've gone and interviewed these guys, and how do you now take all this footage and take everything? You've interviewed all these huge guys.
Right.
And you turn around and you go, how do I now assemble a story that's a cohesive story?
Right. Well, that's why I interviewed so many people. It's like, I got to make sure I get the best stories, you know? The first guy I reached out to, ironically enough, was Liberty DeVito.
Oh, wow.
From Drum Tech, Nate was telling me about his story. I'm like, that can't be real. That could not have happened. So Liberty didn't have a manager, an agent, or a PR person. So I hunted him down on Facebook. And just sent him a private message and was like, look, man, I'm doing this film. I've heard your story. Is it true? Can we get on the phone? And he called me like a couple days later and we spoke for a couple hours. I'm like, okay, you know. And then Rudy Sarzo. Of course, I knew about Rudy. You know, I was a huge metalhead growing up.
Sure.
I was all the pro then. And he was another guy. As soon as we interviewed him that day, I knew that he would be a huge piece in this film. And it's crazy, man. I get emails, I look online or Twitter or whatnot, and it's 90% of all the comments are about how awesome Rudy Sarzo is as a human being. Mm-hmm. Forget the baseball aspect. Just a great person, and it's true. Just a solid human being. Yeah. So, you know, and all the rest of it is just kind of like, okay, well, this story is really cool. So they had these, you know, like the filter store is its own little compartment.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah, there's a few of those. The Bon Jovi thing with Phil Lax, because he's such a great player, and the story is really, really cool.
The filter story I'd never heard, which I thought was kind of interesting. Like, as most people know who listen to the show, we're all musicians. So, like, right. Watching something like this was, like, very, like, we know these guys behind the scenes. We know who they are. Like, the general public doesn't necessarily know who Kenny Aronoff is and doesn't know necessarily who Liberty De- well, Liberty DeVito, I would say, people know.
If you live on Long Island.
If you live on Long Island. Because we're from Long Island. You know, we have that Billy Joel connection. The general public doesn't necessarily know these guys unless you're musicians. So looking at this... it really is an amazing feat to be able to get in touch with all these guys because they're working. Like you said this before, they're working.
Yep.
And
two years doing interviews. How long did the actual editing take?
Well, that's the funny story.
Now, so Gavin Fisher, right? I'm sorry.
Forever, man. We had terabytes and terabytes of hundreds of hours of footage. So once we narrowed down who the main stories we're going to focus on. We just kind of honed in, and initially our first editor was Gavin Fisher, who probably edited 90% of the film that you see today. And, I'd sit with him down, and he was in San Diego at the time, so I'd fly down to San Diego, spend a couple of weeks with him, and we'd flesh out some of these scenes. And, going in, we knew that Liberty would be a great guy, so there's a really tense scene in the film where he's playing the drums, talking about getting divorced, and everything else, he kicks his drums over. So we knew we were going to build a piece on that. So I asked him while we were in the studio, I was like, start off slow and build it up a little bit and get pissed off. You're the last guy playing, so if you want to destroy the drum kit, go for it. And he did. So, Gavin knew my vision for that scene and just nailed it, And same thing with the Rudy Sarzo, Randy Rhoads, plane accident scene. That was...
Yeah,
wanted to treat that with a lot of respect, and Rudy trusted me with that scene. And it was super heavy. It was very difficult for him to go there and talk about that again. And I thank him today for that because that was he wears that on his sleeve. You can see it in the footage. That was all real. It was one take. We were all crying. The whole crew.
Sure.
Gavin did a great job, and then he had to step away for some personal reasons, and we had to keep going. So I reached out to a guy named Tim Calandrello, and he came in and kind of pieced that puzzle together at the last second and finished it out. And I edited a couple of scenes. I don't call myself an editor. Mm-hmm. Like the pink segment, the Just What the Doctor Orders segment, and one more, the Steely Dan section.
Okay.
Which there's a cool story if you want me to tell it about that song. And this goes back to some of the filmmakers wanting to know questions about licensing music.
Sure.
Yeah, that's a big question that I know Joe had actually lined up. We want to know how playing music throughout this documentary, how did licensing go? And so, you can run with that.
I had the pleasure of finding Julie Glaze Houlihan, who was our music clearance person and our supervisor and everybody else. She was so instrumental in getting this film done and all the music. And we did a favored nation deal with everybody that we all agreed on a fee, and they, luckily for us, everybody agreed to it. But if the filmmakers out there don't know, there's two sides to licensing a song. There's the publishing side that goes to the songwriters, and there's the master recording that belongs to the record label, mm-hmm. right? And we had Donald Fagen and Walter Becker, he was still alive at the time, cleared the publishing for us. They gave us permission to use the song. However, the record label denied us, the master. So we were like, what are we going to do?
Mm-hmm.
Jay Braden, if anybody knows, is famous for writing that guitar solo and playing it on the record. So I just took a shot. I mean, I'm good friends with Jay Braden now, and I was comfortable enough to call him. Be like, you still have your studio and all this other stuff. I was like, what do you feel about doing a re-record of the Peg song and recreating that solo? Because here's the situation. He's like, you got any bread? I was like, yeah, man, we got a little bit of money to throw your way. So he's like, I'm in. Give me a week.
Yeah.
I was like, okay. So, man, he came back, and what you hear in Hired Gun is not Steely Dan. It's him. He nailed it.
That's cool.
Not only that, but he used the same 1965 Gibson ES-3 that he played on Steely Dan Custard and the Fender Twin Reverb. 4 years old. I haven't turned the amp on in 25 years.
Wow.
See, now you're talking my scene. I'm a gearhead.
That's
I'm
a great story.
Dying here. I'm like, oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, it's so cool. And then, you know, I went down and interviewed him for some B-roll stuff, talking about him doing the re-recording. He broke out the guitar. It's like, you want to hold it, man? I'm like, I don't want this thing to disintegrate in my hand. like this belongs in a museum, you know?
Wow.
Cool guitar. So if you got any more questions about the music, I'm happy to talk about any of that stuff. But that's
how do you set up that whole like jam session that we saw through? And you have all these guys that just come in and play. You had Liberty and Kenny Arnoff playing drums in the same
two
room.
Two monster drummers banging.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You know?
Well, before you say that, I do want to say the editor did a great job of tying that together, right? Because Rob Zombie said, well, why don't somebody put that type of band together? And then there it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
So how did you assemble that band is the question.
I'd already interviewed everybody that you saw in those jams, right? And lucky for me, that jam happened right around NAMM, so everybody was at NAMM that weekend.
Nice.
So I'm like, hey, guys, I've got this idea of going. We did that at East West Studios in Hollywood. It's a massive recording studio where so many great classic records were made.
Nice.
And I'm like, would you guys be interested? I got 19 of the people. So there's stuff in the can that nobody's ever seen. I mean, we've got like Corky Hale and, you know, Mark Shulman from Pink's band does this crazy solo. And so many other things I just wish that we could have licensed, but we couldn't. You know, Phil Chen, you know, doing Freeway Jam. So I just called them all out. I'm like, hey, man, I've got this open weekend. Are you guys down to do this? Just come jam. And we had one day of rehearsals. And then 3 days at East West, and they just killed it, man. They just all, and no egos. Everybody was so cool. It was a nightmare to put together for me because I had to, you know, produce the entire film. So I had to get, you know, there's 23 people behind the camera you didn't even see. You know, like crew and art and catering and everything else. And it was a nightmare, but so worth it. When I was on set watching it go down, it was just chills. Mm. You know, just, I can't believe Brad Gillis.
Yeah,
ripping a solo over here with Kenny Arnoff on drums, Paul Bushnell on bass, or Rudy on bass.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, Nita Strauss and Phil X and all these Michael Herring, just amazing musicians. Yeah, you know?
And where did this? And, oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Finish.
I was going to say, and the guy that produced the track itself is Johnny Kay, who is a Grammy nominated producer of the year. He did all the Disturbed records, Stained. Three Doors Down. He owed me a favor because I got him a recent gig with Megadeth.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah, and I called out my favorites. I'm like, hey, man, I don't have any money, but remember I got you two Megadeth records? I promise. I was like, I'll fly in because he lives in Chicago and put you up in a hotel, but I don't have any money. So he came in and was so cool, man. You know, just killed it under so much stress.
Right,
you know, manage all those musicians and change. Like, wow, I don't know how you did it. But,
yeah, who actually wrote those songs? Who was in charge? Like, where did the song ideas come from for that?
You know, Michael Fish Herring kind of did the blues jam thing at the end.
Sure.
And he plays guitar for everybody. Now. He was in Prince's band for a while, Christina Aguilera. Just a fantastic musician, a great person. And but that opening jam, I think it was just Phil X came up with that riff. Mm-hmm. You know, at the very beginning of the movie.
Yeah, yeah.
And kind of jumped in and just freestyled. There was no rehearsal of that at all. Hmm. And then the end jam, they just ran through for like 2 or 3 minutes, like, okay, let's just do it, you know. Really cool.
Sure. Yeah. So now, after you've produced and edited and you got this great documentary sitting here in front of you, what's the distribution plan? We know it ends up on Netflix. Was that your first choice? Is that where, you know, the only place you wanted to put it? What, you know, what was the plan when you were making it? And did you stick to that plan, or was Netflix a diversion, you know?
No, not at all. So for me, you know, I wanted this movie to stand out and have legs. We didn't have a distributor at all going into even the South by Southwest is where World premiered the film. And we had been talking to Vision Films for a while, as well as a couple of other sales agents, and we decided to go with Vision. Mm-hmm. And they got us on, you know, they got us a deal with Fathom Events for a one night screening in 320 theaters across the country. Nice. And we went that round. It did really well. And right after that, I think August 1st, we did all of our VOD. And I mean, there's hundreds and hundreds of platforms that maybe you want to, and did really well. And then Sony came in as our arm of our physical distribution worldwide. I think the film's in 26 different languages.
Awesome.
And then, yeah, and we got the Netflix deal early on. You know, we did a screening in New York at the Soho House and had all, you know, the dreaded Weinstein Company was there. we got an offer like the next day from Netflix to pick it up.
Nice.
And December 1st, it went on and it just exploded on there, you know, which was, you know, I wish that the film could have done the same thing outside of Netflix. Because if anybody knows, Netflix is just a licensing deal. They pay you a flat fee.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Individuals for like, okay, 400,000 people watch your movie. Here's a dime for every person that watched it. It's
like, yeah,
a good deal, but you know.
Well, some people do steer away from Netflix because of that. However, right. You have become a success on Netflix.
Yeah, look, I feel so lucky. I really do. I mean, it was due to a lot of hard work by myself and our crew, and of course the cast that were so cool to share their stories with us. Mm-hmm. That made it a compelling film, and once the people actually get to see it, that aren't going to go spend, you know, the $12.99 at Amazon or download it or whatnot. It's great, you know, so happy.
It's funny how, you know, you do things for art that sometimes aren't for the money, you know, because you see it's like your story, Hired Gun, you know, sometimes doesn't lead that direction, but they live their whole lives doing it. And here you are doing this great film about that. And it's almost like the same thing. Like, we, you know, hopefully you get a lot more attention and you keep going. But, you know, sometimes it's just about our art also. And you did a great job. I want to say that.
Yeah, the film has done exactly what I wanted to do, which was kind of elevate my career to the next stepping stone.
Sure.
So kind of work.
You had a little story that we talked about before we went live on air here. And I would love for you to share it because you didn't really delve into it too much. But it's about the mixing process that you went through get the sound correct in this obviously sound-heavy film.
A music documentary needs to have good sound,
right? Yes, absolutely.
Well, any film, all the filmmakers know, it's more important to have better audio than it is picture. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you have nothing, you don't have any sound.
Right.
So I knew the film would look good. You know, we went as good as we could without using film, you know, which my next project will be shot on film, thanks to Kodak. We can get into that as well.
Would love to.
But the mix was, I was like, okay, I got to find a place to mix this thing. So I'm calling all these places in Los Angeles. I live in Northern California, and the thought of just going to LA and spending 2 weeks was not appealing to me. Mm-hmm. I was like, you know what? I know Skywalker Ranch is up 2 miles up the road. I might as well just see what that. I know they're going to say no. I mean, it's, you know, huge. So I sent a vague email to this thing, info@skywalkerranch.com. There's no really formal thing. That's it. They're very locked down.
That's kind of generic for such a big company.
Yeah.
All they have, because I think they want it that way.
Sure.
So I sent them the sizzle reel, a little synopsis. I'm like, hey, I'm a local guy living here in Marin County. You know, a lot of the film, you know, post was done here. Shot some of it here. There's a bunch of musicians here that were in the film. And I get an email the next day. It's like, we have to mix this film.
Wow.
Can we get you a bid together? I'm like, what? Usually I get the first question is, what is your budget?
Right.
How can we submit a bid? So they submitted the bid to me, man. I got to tell you, it was half of what anything in LA would have charged.
Wow.
And I just couldn't believe it. I'm like, would you like to come up and do a walkthrough and, you know, meet your mixer and all this stuff? I'm like, duh. You know what I mean?
So you can't tell Lucasfilm that they you know, they bid half of what anybody else would have.
It was insane, man. And they're in their boutique place. You know what I mean? You can't just go in there with a boatload of money and get your, they have to select you to.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
But it shows they believed in the project. That's what.
So I go there and our mixer was Scott Lewis. Great mixer. He's won a couple of Emmys. He does House of Cards. He just did the new David Fincher Mindhunter thing and fell in love with the project and killed it. Had such a good time. And the question, everybody's like, well, what is Skywalker Ranch like? And my question's always like, whatever you think it is, that's what it is. I can't even put it into words, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's like you're driving there, you're seeing like turkeys and chickens and these Wagyu cows and like vineyards on the hill, bee farms. So anything you eat on property is slaughtered or grown there, including like the apple jam. You know, have an apple orchard.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. It's pretty ridiculous. But yeah, so they killed it. And we got to screen it in the Stag Theater. It's 70,000 watts of power. Each seat has a thumper under it. And I'll never hear my movie sound this good again as long as I live, you know. And it's true that the place is phenomenal. Yeah, really neat.
Wow, that's amazing.
Another thing I'd like to give a shout out to also is the score of the film. The stuff that you don't recognize.
Sure.
Like some of the emotionally charged scenes. I had been using library music, you know, for all the temp stuff. And Julie Houlihan's like, you know, this is going to cost a fortune just for even a library music. You'll come out even or maybe even ahead if you hire a composer to compose an original score. I had no idea. I was like, that's a thing? She goes, oh, yeah. Here's a bunch of agents. Give them a call. Have them give you some of their client stuff. I'm like, okay. So I'm getting stuff and I'm listening to it. And this one lady sent me this stuff from the Crystal Method. It was an EDM band in the, you know, early 2000s.
Oh, I know them, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm like, this is interesting, you know. Would it work in a documentary, though? And held a meeting with Scott Kirkland, who was the head of the Crystal Method, and come to find out, he was a huge metalhead. Man, I'm telling you right now, Quiet Riot was my favorite band on the planet Earth. Please let me score the Randy Rudy scene. Just let me show you I can do it. I was like, okay, no problem. I sent it to him. He sent it back the next morning. I was like, you're hired. You know,
that's awesome.
I only had 2 or 3 weeks, I think, to do the whole thing before he had to go to mix. And they did such a great job. There's so much pressure, too, you know, again. And I'd work with them again in a heartbeat. And the soundtrack for the score is on iTunes, rather. So you can actually buy it. It's so good.
Oh, okay. We'll leave a link to that in the show notes as well.
It's nice when people you work with are passionate about the project as well. It shows through, yes.
Yeah, I mean, these guys do, you know, they do the score for the show. House, Bones, tons, Fast and Furious 7.
Yeah, it's funny. Like, you think about a band like Crystal Method who was around. I mean, I listened to them in college. You know, and it's like, well, what the hell ever happened to them, right? Mm-hmm. They're like, they're doing movie scores now and all this other stuff.
They were doing movie scores and they were touring, you know?
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
Another little tidbit, if anybody watches the film or has seen it and you watch the Jason Newsted scene where Cliff Burton passes away and you hear the bass playing, real somber bass, that is, oh God, I'm going to forget his name now, the bass player for Tool. Justin Chancellor.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, so we had temped that scene with Orion from Master of Puppets. I sent it over, and Scott doesn't play bass. You know, he maybe plays the keys and scratch and stuff, I guess. He's like, dude, did you really have to temp it with this? How do I top, you know, this? So his best friend is Justin Chancellor. So he called him over the weekend and was like, would you take a stab at this and see what you can do, you know? And I guess they went back and forth over the weekend. They sent it to me. I'm like, wait a minute. I thought you said you couldn't play bass. This is amazing. I'm like, Justin Chancellor from Tool. I'm like, good grief.
Yeah.
And under some of the stuff, you have to really listen to it for the Randy Rudy scene, is my good buddy Mike Neushock from the band Stained. Wrote some guitar parts for that thing as well. And very, very glad he did that. He came out really great. He's a good guy.
Cool. Well, I'm sure this film has been already opening up many doors for you. So what's on the horizon? What are you working on something now? Is there something coming down the pike that you're working on?
Yeah, you know, I shot a, I want to say a pilot called Legacy. And there's this great rock photographer named Ash Newell. That I know, that I'm a huge fan of. He's a great photographer. And he approached me and was wanting to do a program based on capturing the essence of some of these huge legacy artists. in a photograph while telling their story. And I thought it was a great concept, so we collaborated on it together, and we shot and we're shopping it now, and we think we have a home for it. There's a couple other stuff I can't really talk about right now because it's getting finalized and paperwork's been done. But I would say there's no less than like four projects right now that I'm kind of, you know, trying to pick which one I really want to do and which would be good for my career, you know. And I tell you, one of them who revolves around is Ray Parker Jr.
Oh wow, that would be that's awesome.
Well, he was also in the documentary too, so I guess you developed a relationship with him.
He's gone all around the world with me. Look, this guy doesn't need to do anything for me. He's so well off financially.
Right.
It's staggering, okay? Not just a little bit of money. We're talking astronomical, hundreds of millions of dollars. And I'm like, why are you doing this, man? He goes, dude, I love traveling. I love your movie. I love that you put me in it, and I appreciate it, and I see how hard you're working on it. And he gave me some really good advice. You know, he's like a mentor almost. You know, I love the guy to death. He's so cool. And he literally went, like, we went to Australia. We've gone to Portland. We've gone to Chicago, everywhere. I don't know. We've probably spent together 20 times so far.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and getting to know the guy. Of course, you know, we interviewed him for Hired Gun, but there's stuff he left out. He just got home from Japan the night before when we did the interview with him. But you know, I don't know if anybody remembers the or is familiar with the civil unrest in Detroit during 1967 with the riots.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he was 12 years old at the time, and he lived on that street where the riots were happening.
Wow.
For him, just getting from school to home was a big thing, right?
Yeah, I love when he said, does it bother you when someone says, oh, who are you going to call? You know, like when you hear the same thing over there. He said, why would that bother me? You know, he made an impact on society worldwide. They know that, Ghostbusters song.
You know, that song to me is bigger than the movie ever was, to be honest with you. Yeah, and he gets attacked everywhere he goes. Like, you know, and he loves it. He doesn't take it for granted. And he genuinely loves the attention he gets from it. But what people fail to realize is he had a whole career as a side guy.
Right.
Way before he was even an artist on his own. I mean, he's played with Marvin on the Marvin Gaye records. He played on Superstitious with Stevie Wonder.
Yeah,
wow. Barry White records, Diana Ross. I mean, massive. Aretha Franklin.
Wow.
Patti LaBelle. I mean, you know, he wrote songs too for people like Chaka Khan, Tradition. Tons of artists he wrote for.
Well, if Ray's available for interview, we'd love to talk with him.
Yeah, that's true.
Seconds, man. He loves doing this stuff. I can definitely arrange that for you.
Oh my God, that would be so cool. But yeah.
Yeah. So for me, there's really a compelling story there about his journey that I think needs to be told. And, you know, that's one thing I definitely would love to work on. Nice. You know,
very cool. Awesome. Well, Fran, thanks so much for sharing your story with us. This was great. I mean, as musicians, like I said, we really wanted to talk to you and hear what your journey was like and what it was like for you to work with all these guys. So we really appreciate you coming on.
As a fellow filmmaker and musicians, rock on.
Yeah, look, if I can do it, anybody can. It just came from a small idea to a reality. You know, the one thing I will tell all the filmmakers and anybody else out there, and musicians as well, is what David Foster told me as a little piece of advice. He's like, man, he goes, yeah, I'm good. He goes, but I surround myself with people better than me, and it makes me look better in the end. Sure. So don't ever be afraid to, like, you know, and I surround myself, look, my DP and editors and everybody else blow me away, and I welcome it, you know, because they killed it, you know.
Yeah, it's awesome, man. Well,
and if anybody in the LA area is looking for sound guy, Thomas Corcoran is your dude. He got the biggest compliment at Skywalker Ranch. Our mixer was like, this is the best sounding, consistent audio of a documentary I've ever worked on in my career.
Wow.
And that's a testament to his knowledge and work skills. So, yeah.
Wow.
That's awesome. Yeah, I mean, the sound was definitely solid and it was noticeable because, you know, I play everything through my surround sound at home when I watched it through Netflix. And so, I mean, I heard everything. It was great.
Nice. Well, thanks again for having me on.
Thank you.
If you want to see the behind-the-scenes footage, Amazon.com. You can buy the DVD or Blu-ray there. There's like an hour worth of bonus material on there. It's jaw-dropping. So.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Okay.
Do you have any Facebook, anything like that you'd like to share with our audience? Any other contact?
Yeah, I think all our handles are just Hired Gun Film.
Yep.
For Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, all the like. Yeah.
Okay.
Go check. You'll like it. And, share it with all your friends and family. Yeah. Great film.
Fran, thank you very much for spending your night with us.